We'll hear argument next in number 04-1371, Miro, Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith versus Dobbitt. Mr. Kasner.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in an effort to limit state law securities class actions, which undermine the market for nationally traded securities, Congress enacted SLUSA, a statute of broad preemption. SLUSA, which is reprinted at page 8A of Petitioner's Blue Brief, preempts subject to three specific statutory exemptions all state law-covered class actions, quote, by any private party who alleges misrepresentations, omissions, or fraudulent behavior in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. The Second Circuit erred in implying an exception that nowhere appears in the statutory language and is wholly at odds with the purpose in the enactment of the statute for holders' claims, a type of claim in which a plaintiff alleges, I did not purchase or I did not sell, but would have had I known the allegedly false information, a type of claim which this Court in blue chip stamps over 30 years ago recognized as the most vexatious and abusive type of securities class action claim. The Court below erred for a number of different reasons. First and foremost, it completely violated the natural meaning of the statute. As I have mentioned, an examination of SLUSA beginning at page 8A reflects that no covered class action may be maintained, quote, by any private party, a clause that this Court time and again has interpreted as perhaps the broadest way of phrasing any and all private parties making certain types of allegations. Those allegations appear in A or B, focusing on the conduct of the defendant in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. Now, Congress could have, had it intended to inject a purchase or seller limitation consistent with what the Court below concluded, Congress could have phrased that language differently. As the Court is aware, in both the 1933 and 1934 Acts, Congress has made express causes of action subject to an explicit purchase or seller requirement. For example, Section 11 of the 33 Act affords a private right of action to purchasers of securities in registered offerings. Section 12 affords a private right of action to persons from whom an offer or sale of securities. Section 9E of the 34 Act similarly affords a purchase or seller requirement. Significantly, SLUSA nowhere speaks in terms of a purchase or sale, and it could have. For example, Congress could have provided that no covered class action by any private party alleging his or her sale of a covered security is preempted. It could have said any private party alleging a misrepresentation or omission of a material fact in connection with the plaintiff or that party's purchase or sale. It did not. The decision of the Court below is also at odds with this Court's teaching in United States versus O'Hagan, which was decided 1 year before SLUSA was enacted by Congress. In United States versus O'Hagan, this Court concluded that the so-called misappropriation theory stated a viable claim in a criminal case brought by the United States government. In responding to an argument by the defendant that no one involved that had been defrauded purchased
May
or
sold. May I just ask you this question about the plain language? If the word in 1F1A had not been in connection with the purchase of sale of security, had been in connection with his or her purchase or sale, then it would have been covered, would it not?
Justice Stevens, if by his or her it's referencing any private party, I would agree with that. That would be a different
case. So the question is whether we should construe the word the to be the functional equivalent of his or her.
In essence, Justice Stevens, that's correct, and I think that that question has been answered by this Court on a number of different occasions. Again, in United States versus O'Hagan, this Court concluded that the in connection with the purchase or sale of a security does not mean in connection with the purchase or sale by another party to the securities transaction, but rather means in connection with the purchase or sale by anyone.
Mr. Kasner, does the Securities Exchange Commission have enforcement authority in this in this area?
It does, Justice Scalia.
Have they issued any rules or regulations on this point?
The point being, Your Honor, whether —
on the point that you're arguing, whether the critical language means the person's own sale or not.
Yes, Your Honor. In adjudicatory proceedings referenced in our brief, the SEC has unanimously and uniformly taken the position that it does not. In briefs to this court, in criminal prosecutions and civil prosecutions, the government has consistently taken the position, as it has in this case as an amicus, and as it did in the court below.
Is it your position that we owe deference to the interpretation of the SEC?
That is our position, Your Honor. We do take the position that this court should defer to the views of the SEC on that issue. What that deference is, should it be Chevron or Skidmore, is not a question Your Honor has asked. I'm happy to say that we believe, vis-a-vis 10b-5.
Oh, if it's just Skidmore, forget about it. I mean, that's...
Well, Your Honor, I actually carefully studied yesterday's opinion where this court discussed the Skidmore deference, and either way, we think that the statute is so clear that deference or none. There really is no other way to read the language of the statute. As I say, this court in United States versus O'Hagan concluded squarely that this language does not mean the purchase or sale of the plaintiff's securities. Justice O'Connor's concurring opinion, joined in by Justice Stevens in the Holmes case, makes that same point. Significantly, Your Honors, the in connection with language as a statutory matter has consistently been construed by the Securities and Exchange Commission and by this court as one of incredible breadth. Most recently in United States versus Zanford, this court concluded that the in connection with the purchase or sale language means anything that coincides with a securities transaction. And what is significant in this case, it is conceded by the respondent at page 8 of his brief that the conduct alleged by the plaintiff below is in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. There really can be no other conclusion. At myriad paragraphs in the pleadings, appearing among others at Joint Appendix 53, paragraph 4, Joint Appendix 53A, paragraph 5, Joint Appendix 59 to 60.
Mr. Kasner, may I just interrupt those references to ask you? One could agree that for SEC enforcement purposes, for prosecutorial purposes, the in connection with is as broad as you suggest. But for purposes of private action, it isn't that broad. It is limited, as this court said, in blue chip stamps. It is possible for the same words, even in the same statute, in different contexts, to mean different things.
Justice Ginsburg, I believe that this court has answered Your Honor's question in the blue chip stamp case, where it specifically rejected that sort of an approach and the one that was consistent with the court below. What the court in blue chip stamp, which of course was a civil case involving an alleged holder's claim, was a class action. What this court said, for purposes of a civil proceeding, this purchase or seller requirement nowhere appears in the statutory language. The statute clearly says in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. But as a statutory matter, this court concluded, Your Honor, that a violation of 10b-5 had been alleged, notwithstanding going on to conclude that the plaintiff could not recover as a matter of private cause of action. So we understand, we believe, Your Honor, that it — and it is undisputed on this record — that all parties agree, as the court below concluded, that this Congress intended to impart 10b-5 interpretation as a statutory matter into SLUSA. We also think, Justice Ginsburg, that were Your Honors to conclude that somehow in connection with means something different in a civil context, a narrower reading than in the broader context, that would, of course, violate, in our view, the rule of lenity that is applied by this court. It would also mark what we believe to be the first time, insofar as we have been able to determine, and respondent cites no authority to the contrary, in which the same provisions in a statute that have civil and criminal application.
Explain the rule of lenity, because on criminal, it is as broad as can be. I didn't know that there was a rule of lenity that applied strictly to civil liability.
Your Honor, we have cited authority, including the Leocal decision of this Court last year, in which for statutory construction purposes, where you have a civil and a criminal statute that has both elements to it, the rule of lenity would dictate that the narrower reading be the one that is written. So in other words, if this Court were to have concluded in United States versus O'Hagan, that as a criminal matter, the in connection with language is not tethered to the purchase or sale by a particular party in the case, that is a broader reading than the reading that the Court below adopted in a civil case. And so what we're urging is that the rule of lenity would suggest that if this Court in U.S. v. O'Hagan took the view that the purchase or sale requirement does not apply in a criminal context, that should also apply in a civil context, that a narrower reading should not be imparted into a civil context than you would find in a criminal context.
One reason you might want to adopt a narrower reading, though, is we're dealing here with the preemption provision. It's one thing to say that when you're talking about the SEC's enforcement powers, you adopt a broad reading, but it's quite another thing when you're talking about displacing state law that you would necessarily adopt the same broad reading.
Mr. Chief Justice, I think in this case there is no other purpose to be served by this statute than to preempt. To the extent that embedded in Your Honor's question is a question with respect to the so-called presumption against preemption, we don't think that those concerns or the concerns to which Your Honor just referred apply in this case because the statute is clear. There is no ambiguity in the language that Congress used, and it would have made no sense, Mr. Chief Justice, for Congress to have.
There's a lot of — I think our case has established that a phrase like in connection with carries with it a lot of ambiguity. You don't know exactly how rigorous the connection has to be. I mean, an auto accident by a broker who's leaving his office, he wouldn't be in the office if he weren't buying and selling securities. I mean, is that auto accident in connection with the purchase and sales of securities? No. And yet, you know, theoretically it could be. There's a lot of ambiguity in determining how much breadth to give that phrase.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, I would agree with you that in terms of deciding as a substantive matter for purposes of 10b-5 in connection with, such as in SEC versus Zanford, how far the outer reaches of the in connection with language go may well be susceptible of differences of opinion. There is no difference of opinion to which there can be any disagreement in this case about the plain language of the preemption, because the conduct, no matter what the conduct is that is involved in connection with the purchase or sale of securities, one thing that is totally crystal clear based on this Court's cases and congressional purpose is that the in connection with the purchase or sale language as used here does not restrict its application to the purchase or sale by the plaintiff such that —
But that's a normal reading of the words. When you say a purchaser, it normally would be in connection with the purchase or sale of securities by the party to the litigation. That would be your first take on it. But then you say, well, we have cases out there that construe it a little more narrowly. And is it not somewhat unusual — and I know it's not totally unusual — for Congress to preempt a state cause of action that without where there is no parallel federal remedy?
Justice Stevens, one misimpression I believe that the Court below was under, and I believe is perpetuated by Respondent and his amici, this statute does not preempt a state law claim. This is not like the cases, for example —
Just preempts class
actions. It preempts class actions. And it's significant because Congress made a policy judgment. As originally introduced in the House, SLUSA would have preempted all state law securities cases, all of them. As the statute wound its way through the House and the Senate, it and principally in response to testimony by the SEC Commissioner Leavitt, who went to the Hill three separate times on this legislation, specific statutory exemptions were put in. Getting back, though, to the purpose
— Going through that legislative history, did you find any evidence that they intended to preempt any state law claims that did not have a parallel federal claim?
Justice Stevens, the
other than the language of the statute.
Well, we believe that this inquiry
begins and... You brought up the legislative history, yes. So you're an expert on that. Yeah.
Your Honor, Justice Stevens, the only reference to the purchaser or seller issue is one that is referenced by the respondent. And in that instance, a professor from Cornell, Professor Painter, went to the Hill, and he said, if you enact this statute, you are going to be closing off claims of people who are not purchasers or sellers because those cannot be brought in the federal court. But back for a moment, though, to the issue of what is not preempted in the policy behind the statute, there was another component that Congress was seeking to remedy here, and that was the so-called safe harbor. In 1995, when Congress enacted the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, one piece of that was an effort to encourage public companies to make predictive statements publicly. There had been a rash of litigation at the time against public companies whose predictive statements proved false. And so Congress said, wait a minute, we will allow you an insulation from liability if your forward statements prove false, if the plaintiff cannot allege either that they were made with actual knowledge or not accompanied by meaningful cautionary language. Another purpose of this statute was
hey,
to —
may I interrupt because I'm —
yes.
Your time is running out. Is my understanding correct that on your reading, state class actions of less than 50 parties are also left unpreempted?
Justice Souter, the definition — yes. The answer to your question is yes.
Individual actions and small state class actions.
Individual actions, less than 50 people, arbitrations, public enforcement. And with that, Mr. Chief Justice, I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Kastner. Mr. Hungar.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The fundamental flaw in the Court of Appeals analysis is that it requires the phrase in connection with to be given two different and irreconcilable interpretations depending on the identity of the plaintiff. Nothing in the text or history of the securities laws justifies that implausible interpretation. The Securities and Exchange Commission and
I just wonder if that's correct. Am I not right to say that if the word "the" had been read to mean his or her, that argument would not apply?
I think that's correct, Justice Stevens.
So then you don't have to have differing interpretations of in connection with. You just have to know what the word "the" means.
Well, the in connection — that's not the approach that the Court of Appeals took, of course. Yeah. But and also, as Mr. Kastner indicated, that issue has been dispositively resolved by this Court and the Commission in concluding that the purchaser-seller rule is not a limitation on the scope of the prohibition in Section 10b. And if your interpretation were the one that were adopted, that would not be the case.
I always thought "the" meant "the."
Certainly that would
and
be
our — and "his" or "her" means "his" or "her."
Yes, Your Honor. And again —
No, no, you think it means "any."
I'm sorry?
You think it means "any," right? You're reading "the" to mean "any."
Right. It's "the" — well, it's "the" in the sense of the activity of purchasing and selling securities, yes. It's — and that's how this Court has interpreted in the O'Hagan case. If that interpretation, if "the" were read as "his" or "her," then it's impossible to see how the SEC could bring an enforcement action or the Justice Department could bring a prosecution in a case like O'Hagan, where the Court specifically said that the purchaser or seller was not defrauded. It's not true that Section 10b requires that the purchaser or seller be defrauded. And so we submit that —
Certainly doesn't require the Commission to be a purchaser or seller either. No.
Well, we certainly would agree with that, Your Honor. But more generally, it doesn't require that there be a purchaser or seller who's defrauded, and yet the purchaser-seller rule for the purpose of implied actions does require that. Justice Stevens, you asked about whether there is any indication in the legislative history that Congress intended this act to preempt class action claims where there would be no federal remedy. The answer to that is absolutely yes. It is perfectly clear from the legislative history that Congress knew and expected that claims that could be brought under state law as class actions, such as aiding and abetting claims or negligent misrepresentation claims, claims that would not satisfy the federal scienter requirements, and, of course, the claims that would not satisfy the requirements of the PSLRA, none of those could be brought in federal court because they're barred by the various provisions of federal law.
But they would be judged under a different standard. You're dead right. But as far as the parties involved, That's what I was really asking.
Well, in cases where the only claim is against aiders and abettors, those parties would be out of court. Or likewise, cases where parties could not satisfy the scienter requirement, those parties would be out of court. So Congress knew that it would be foreclosing remedies for certain categories of claims, and that was part of the point of the Act, as the Conference Committee report makes clear. Congress
was concerned. What about the claim that's made here, the second claim? The broker said, we lost clients, so as a result of this deception, we want to be compensated for that. Nothing about the inflated price of the security. Just that our clients don't trust us anymore because we gave them such bad advice.
Your Honor, that issue is not before this Court.
I know, but I wanted to know what the government's position was on that claim. Could that be brought in a state court, even as a class action?
The Commission addressed that question in its amicus brief in the Court of Appeals and took the position that that claim was not in connection with the purchase or sale of securities because the injury occurs after the fraud has been completed and has to do with the lost future relationship rather than fraud in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. And so we didn't address that in our brief here, obviously, but the Commission took the position below that would not be preempted because it's not in connection with the purchase or sale of securities.
How do you deal with the court's — the footnote in the blue chip stamp that the court said, in the federal court, these 10B actions have to be limited to actual purchases and sellers, but that limitation is attenuated because deserving claims by non-traders would lie under state law, including the very suit that was involved in blue chip stamps and in the Second Circuit case that paved the way for blue chip.
Your Honor, that was an accurate description of the state of the law as it existed at the time, at least in theory, although as a practical matter, respondents have not been able to point to a single reported case of a holder class action in state court prior to the adoption of the Uniform Standards Act. So while it was true as a theoretical matter that such claims could be brought under the law of some states, there's no history of state class actions in this area, which is one of the reasons why we think the reliance on the assumption of non-preemption makes no sense here. Securities class actions prior to the PSLRA were brought in federal court. And it was only the PSLRA that resulted in cases such as the type of case at issue here being brought in state courts. And Congress, once it saw that problem, Congress was concerned that the requirements of the PSLRA were being evaded. And it was also concerned, as the Conference Committee report makes clear, that now that these securities class actions were being brought in state court, there was the potential danger of 50 varying state standards being applied, as this very case suggests. And Congress acted to remedy both of those problems, as the Conference Committee report makes clear, both the risk of non-uniformity in securities class actions that are targeted by the Act and the risk of evasion of the PSLRA. Respondents' position would frustrate both of those objectives because it would permit the most abusive category of lawsuits to proceed in state court, and it would permit such holder claims to be brought, for instance, based on negligence, if state law permitted that, based on conduct that would be protected by the federal safe harbor for forward-looking statements under the PSLRA. So the PSLRA protections would be frustrated by their interpretation. So the very goals that Congress explicitly sought to achieve, stated in the text of the statute, in the purposes section, and also in the Conference Committee report, would be frustrated. And again, that approach requires the court to accept an inconsistent interpretation of the text of the in connection with requirement depending on the identity of the plaintiff, which would be an extraordinary way to construe a statute, particularly when there's nothing in the legislative history that provides even a hint of a suggestion that Congress would have intended that result. And with respect to Blue Chip, Your Honor, it's important to remember what Blue Chip was doing. Blue Chip was not a case about the scope of the in connection with requirement or the Section 10B prohibition. Instead, it was a case about what to infer about what Congress would have wanted to authorize as a right of action if it had addressed the question. And that's why the Blue Chip Court made very clear that the conduct at issue there involving injuries to holders can be a violation of Section 10B, i.e., it can be in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. It's just that they did not think that Congress would have wanted to authorize the private right of action. So, again, when we're talking about the scope of the in connection with requirement, which is what is at issue here, that approach is the same approach that should be followed here, the same approach that was followed in O'Hagan and in Zanford, and compels the conclusion that since the conduct at issue here is unquestionably in connection with the purchase and sale of securities, as this Court has construed that phrase, it is preempted by the Uniform Standards Act. If the Court has no further questions, I thank the Court.
Thank you, Mr. Hungar. Mr. Frederick?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Our position is that SLUSA does not preempt class actions asserting holder claims. Congress incorporated this Court's interpretation of in connection with from blue chip stamps when it enacted SLUSA. SLUSA rechanneled state suits to federal court. It was not designed to eliminate state remedies that could not be pursued as federal 10b-5 claims. That interpretation is the better reading of the text, the context, and the history of SLUSA's handling of private securities actions. If I could start with the text.
Can you tell me, do you agree that a holder action falls within 10b-5 generally?
No, because this Court in the blue chip stamps case said that it did not. In footnote 5, Justice Rehnquist.
What about enforcement actions taken by the
In enforcement SEC. Actions, the SEC can bring enforcement authority pursuant to 10b-5. And so to that extent, misconduct that would be connected to what in a private context would be deemed a holder claim does fall within the SEC's
holder actions do fall within 10b-5 for some purposes.
They do. For enforcement purposes, they do not for private civil action purposes.
So you want us to interpret the text two ways, depending on the purpose?
No. What I want you to do is to understand what Congress intended. And what Congress intended in SLUSA, I think, is quite clear if you start at the beginning of the statute and you just start reading your way through it. Because what Congress did in SLUSA was attempt to stop a flight of cases that had been brought in federal court heretofore, but were migrating to state court, Congress perceived, as a result of the enactment of the PSLRA. Section 2 of SLUSA, and it is very important, Your Honors, that you look carefully at Section 2 of SLUSA because it has five congressional findings. They are not adequately briefed or even discussed by the Second Circuit, but one of them says that the PSLRA sought to prevent abuses. The second one says, since the enactment of that, Congress perceives that a number of securities class action lawsuits have shifted from federal to state courts. The third one says that shift has prevented the Act from achieving its objectives. The next one says state securities regulation is of continuing importance. And then the fifth one says, in order to prevent certain state private securities class actions alleging fraud from being used to frustrate the objectives of the PSLRA, it is appropriate to enact these national standards.
The government doesn't say that all are covered. The government acknowledges that there are some actions that could still be brought in state court.
The point, though, Justice Scalia, is that what Congress in the PSLRA was doing was attempting to ratchet up the pleading requirements for federal law claims.
So it's so counterintuitive, as the government points out. These holder claims lend themselves to abuse much more than do the narrow purchase and sale claims.
Absolutely
and
not.
Why the government would want to police the one and let the other, proliferate seems very strange to me.
That's not correct, Justice Scalia, and it's important to emphasize this. What the Court addressed in the blue chip stamps case was a very different kind of case. It involved non-purchasers, and the Court reasoned that it would be speculative for somebody out there to say, well, I would have purchased a security had I known. A holder claim, as recognized for a century in various state courts involves a claim by somebody who holds a security and is induced by fraud not to sell that security. The restatement of torts, section 525, recognizes that the fraud by forbearance to cause you not to take an action is just as much a fraud as one that induces you.
But the fraud is caused — the fraud causes other people to want to buy the security. They do so at a higher price. It causes the price to go up. It's in connection with a purchase or sale, maybe not of the holder's securities, but it's certainly — the holder's claim wouldn't exist but for purchases and sales that cause the price to go up.
In most circumstances, that's correct, Mr. Chief Justice, but that, I don't think, is material. The level of damages that a holder sustains should not determine what the elements of the liability are. And what is striking about the government and Merrill Lynch's position here is that intentional fraud is going to be given a pass because of those persons who are uniquely harmed because for 20 years —
But what your clients want to do is cash in on the fraud. They don't — their claim is that they didn't get to sell the stock at an inflated price to somebody who didn't know about the fraud. That's the damages that they want to collect. And that seems to be an odd claim to recognize.
That's the same kind of claim that, and to get back to Justice Scalia's question, arises in the purchaser-seller context. The only difference is that the measure of damages is computed by when you purchase or sell as opposed to when you bought it before the fraud occurred. I mean, Wall Street has been telling investors for two or more decades, buy and hold, rest your retirement, hold your securities.
Suppose a person bought the stock at price 30 before any fraud took place, and then he holds it, and then the fraud, and then subsequently the word of the fraud gets out, the price falls a lot, and he sells it. Does he have a claim under federal ordinary, you know, can he go into federal court?
No.
No.
Blue chip stamp said no.
Yeah.
And state courts, in the Weinberger case that we cite, they very carefully say this was not a state court class action. But what Judge Friendly in the Weinberger case addressed was a state law holder class action.
And I see that. And then what's worrying me is this, that one thing worrying me is that let's take an ordinary buyer case, all right? And what would happen is that some buyers would like to bring a fraud suit in federal court. They have to go to federal court. Now, they can't go into state court. But they have a little brainstorm, or the lawyers do, and they say, well, in any case where a buyer would have a claim, and we don't want to go into federal court, there surely are going to be a class of holders that would also have the kind of claim you say. So there we are, same actions, all in the state court, just happens we found a different class of plaintiff. And there always will be such a class.
There will be, in most circumstances, there are some circumstances where harms are unique to holders. But, Justice Breyer, can I point out to you that in the antitrust context, there is, under Illinois BRIC, a requirement that you must be in the direct chain and a direct purchaser, but there are some 30 states that have allowed standing for people that
That's
are indirect
fine. And
purchasers.
That's fine. And what I'm not facing in the antitrust area is what it seems to me on your interpretation now would be Congress passes a law which becomes a futile act, because what they're anxious is to do is to get the cases in the class actions, not all the cases, but the class actions in the federal court, and then in every single case — or 99.999%, where we've kept this action out of federal court, there's going to be a comparable action with holders as the plaintiff in a state court. Now, that's my concern.
And let me address that this way. What Congress was very clear in the legislative debates was it did not want to cut off meritorious claims. It simply wanted to rechannel them.
Can you ease my concern there? Is there anything you can say that could ease my concern that we'll have the same set, but they'll just be in state court with a different class?
Many states don't recognize holder claims as a matter of state law, and they have the same kinds of heightened pleading requirements that were imposed under the PSLRA.
And by the way, my concern is not that it's a bad thing, in quotes. My concern is that it's hard for me to think Congress would have done something that wouldn't have had much effect.
I think your concern should be, what did Congress intend?
Well, what do you make of
that?
And I don't think Congress intended to eliminate a swath of class actions concerning a type of claim that this Court had said could not be brought under
Well, then what do you make of the legislative history? I mean, your friend on the other side pointed out that there was very clear testimony to the effect that if the statute passed with the text that we're dealing with, that it would indeed cut out a series of claims.
I don't think that that was — if you read that in context, I don't think that it was a statement by the Speaker in that instance of Congress's intent to go beyond those claims that were cognizable under federal law and to cut off a whole category of claims that were unique to state law.
Mr. Frederick, you mentioned cutting off a whole category of claims, and earlier you said they didn't want to give a pass to this kind of claim. But this is not a pass because there are all sorts of remedies retained, derivative suits, 49-person actions, and so forth. And are you aware — you mentioned the 100 years of state precedent. Is there any precedent in state law for class actions for holder claims?
Well, we think the Weinberger case recognized that class actions could be brought under New York law. It was a federal case.
But this is not a case where we have a 100-year body of law of class action after class action brought on state law grounds for this type of claim.
True, but in the 90s you had a unique form of fraud that was being perpetrated on Wall Street that did affect holders in a unique way, and we've highlighted market timing in our briefs. In that circumstance, it would be futile for 49 holders to get together and assert that they had been harmed by market timing because the aggregate of their harm is so small that you really have to look at it in a large context. John Bogle, the head of Vanguard for many years and one of the most respected mutual fund advisors, says that there are as many as $5 billion lost by people who buy and hold, as we've been taught to do by Wall Street, but whose aggregate losses accrete every year by virtue of market timing. That is a unique harm caused to holders, which under their theory would not be cognizable because it would be preempted, and it would be impossible as a practical matter for someone to get together with 48 of his or her fellow victims and try to bring a claim to redress that. There's no evidence.
You're describing the present importance of the class, but I don't think you've answered my question about as a matter of history. We don't have a history of timer claims.
We don't have a history of timer claims, but what we also don't have, Justice Stevens, is an indication by Congress throughout the entire legislative debate or the conference reports or anything where holder claims, which had been brought, were perceived to be a problem and were perceived to be within the ambit of what Congress was doing. Because remember
— because they — I mean, the argument made by the government, of course not, because the only reason they're brought is precisely to evade this congressional legislation. They didn't exist before, and they've become common afterwards. Now, you can say that —
They could not be brought under federal law before — and I would acknowledge that because of a series of this Court's decisions, it is easier to prove a purchaser-seller claim where the facts warrant that under 10b prior to the PSLRA than it was to prove a holder claim. Judge Friendly, in the Weinberger opinion, makes very clear that the value to be attributed to the class action settlement there has to be diminished because of the difficulty of proof of such claims.
But I thought that there were — well —
I'd like to address the point that the government makes about how this would supposedly affect the SEC's enforcement authority.
Before you get to that, just, Mr. Frederick, the logic of it, here Congress is tightening the requirements for class actions. But then there is this class, which Blue Chip did say there's a lot, room for a lot of abuse in holder classes, would be left to the state courts for whatever strict or lenient rules. So why would Congress, with respect to this category, want there to be a more plaintiff-friendly rule than the rule that Congress has just put in place for the purchaser-seller 10B actions?
Justice Ginsburg, I don't think that it's correct to characterize it as more plaintiff-friendly. If you're in Minnesota, you can't bring one of these claims because state law doesn't recognize it.
Well, at least in some states.
In some states, you — where the common law or the state statutes recognize these claims, all that we're arguing is that Congress didn't focus on these. And the normal presumption against preemption, you don't, you know, cut through a wide swath of claims where Congress hasn't expressed an intent specifically to preempt them. That's our position, and particularly where the congressional findings —
But you're admitting that anomaly could be part of the scene, that you'd have a state that allows you to sue for negligence and doesn't have heightened pleading requirements for holder claims. And so those claims would be treated more — in a more plaintiff-friendly way than — Federal claims.
Yeah, certainly just as breach of fiduciary duty and breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing are state law claims, negligence is a state law claim, all of those give rise to variations state by state. But what Congress was getting at were fraud claims that were federal law fraud claims. And when it did so, it was heightening the pleading requirements and seeing what people were doing was taking what were federal law claims and migrating them to state court under ostensibly more lenient standards.
Well, why, on your theory, suppose you're right. You're right. I assume that. You can have these holder claims. Well, why couldn't any buyer who has to go to federal court because he has a buyer claim just say, I'll bring a holder claim?
He can't do that under the Second Circuit's test because —
I know, but what I'm asking is what's the logic of that? I mean, you're either right or you're wrong. If Congress didn't want to cut off the holder claim, they didn't. So what's to show that they wanted to cut it off for some people but not other people?
The logic is that for the buyers of those claims, they are meeting the federal standard of in connection.
Not in this suit. Not in this suit.
Yes, they are, because they're buying — the reason why these people have, under the Second Circuit standard, which we think is correct, is that you had to have bought the stock before the fraud, and you were holding it throughout that period of fraud. And so your purchase is not in connection with the fraud, the misrepresentation. But somebody who sees the prospectus, who sees what Mr. Blodgett was saying, which was that there were stocks that were, quote, a piece of crap, but they were giving them the highest buy recommendation, those people are making their purchase in connection with the fraud.
So if I'm both, I bought it in May in reliance on this ridiculous thing, buggy whips make gold. I believed it. I bought buggy whips. Now, we're now in December, and every month they kept repeating it. And my claim is, yeah, I know I bought it in May in reliance, but I kept it in July because I kept seeing it repeated and repeated.
I think actually under the Second Circuit standard that —
The Second Circuit I do not, but I want to know why not.
Well, I think that the reason why not is that if the fraud is affecting the plaintiff's decision to purchase, then that falls within SLUSA and that is preempted, although you're allowed to have a federal remedy under that standard. You're rechanneled to federal court. But if you buy — to use your hypothetical, you buy in January, but the fraudulent misrepresentations are not made until May or June, you're precluded from bringing a federal law claim.
What if I choose not to complain about my buying? I just choose to complain about my holding. It's true. I was harmed because I jumped in, and that's one harm. But it's an entirely separate harm that I was induced to hold it by these continuing misrepresentations. Why can't that part of the suit be brought in state court?
That's our position.
It is? Okay. So you agree that a buyer whose purchase is excluded can nonetheless sue
No, I'm sorry. I misunderstood your hypothetical. I thought your hypothetical was that if you bought prior to the fraud —
No. You bought —
If you bought in connection with the fraud,
yeah.
Then you are forced into federal court.
Why? I have a buying claim and I have a holding claim. What is there in the statute that says the two have to go with each other?
That was the decision that Congress made.
Where?
In this preemption provision.
I'm not making a buying claim. And there's nothing in my complaint about my buying the stock. I was induced to hold the stock by these representations that occurred in February, March, April, and May. I bought in January, also in reliance on fraud, but I'm not complaining about that.
What the Second Circuit said, which I think is correct, is that your damages have to be totally and apart from the fraud as a purchaser, and that where the reason why they set this time frame for holder claims is that those kinds of claims that you're talking about, Justice Scalia, would be a classic purchaser-seller type claim, and you can bring that in federal court. And that's the point here, that where you've got long-term holders and you've got people who purchased in the 80s or in the 70s, and they're being induced to hold for decades, and they may want to make they may suffer their damages as a result of collateral that they want to borrow against. They have no practical means of recovery.
As a practical matter, my damages from the holding may be much greater than my damages from the initial purchase. And you're saying, tough luck, Charlie. You bought a month too soon, or a month too late. You should have bought before the fraud.
What the Second Circuit said, which I think is correct, is that that becomes a level of line drawing that we don't think Congress did intend to get into.
I agree with you, but that's the trouble, because in order to make the Second Circuit's argument, you have to say the following. Congress couldn't have intended to allow people who have a buyer claim to make a totally separate holder claim, because that would gut the statute. And they wouldn't want to engage in a futile act. But now you're asking us to do about the same thing when you talk about a person who doesn't have the buyer claim. You're trying to get us to say Congress thought. See, Congress thought an individual action there, their own separate action in a state court, wasn't good enough. It would have wanted to preserve the holder claim for them. Now, that's possible. But it requires me to think Congress is going through quite a few hoops here.
The hoops that Congress went to and which I've articulated in the congressional findings are that the particular harm that Congress was addressing in SLUSA, this was a narrowly framed preemption as to federal law claims, because the PSLRA only governed federal law claims. And if you could not bring a holder claim under federal law because of blue chip stamps, you were forced into state court. Okay? So when Congress is debating the evasion of the PSLRA, it is only talking about federal law claims. And there's nothing in the legislative history that they've cited or that we have found to suggest that Congress gave any thought to preempting a class of holder claims. Now, certainly,
Frederick, can I ask sort of a background question? Ever since Blue Chip, it's been on the books for a long time, has Congress ever considered legislation that would expand the 10b-5 private remedy to include holder claims?
I'm not aware of legislation, Your Honor.
I'm not either. I'm just wondering if there was some.
But what this Court did say in Blue Chip Stamps was that when the Birnbaum decision, and it was an interpretation of in connection with purchase or sale by what one justice on this Court described as the mother court of the Court of Appeals. It was Chief Judge Swan, Judge Augustus Hand, and Judge Learned Hand, and they construed the words in connection with purchase or sale to mean the plaintiff's purchase or sale.
Blue Chip did not adopt the rationale of the Birnbaum case.
Well, I think it did adopt the rule, though, as a basis of the wording. And if you look at page 733 of the Court's opinion, it was adopting the rationale in the sense that it saw Birnbaum as a construction of the language, and it adopted that. And then in note 5, when Justice Rehnquist's opinion says it would be odd to read in connection with purchase or sale to give a, quote, cause of action to everybody in the world, I think it's clear that that was suggesting that state law could recognize something that this Court said was not recognized under federal law.
Mr. Frederick, it seems to me that the language in connection with, you know, whether it means what the blue chip meant or whether it means what the statute meant, is at least ambiguous. And if that's the case, why shouldn't we be guided by the Securities and Exchange Commission's determination under Chevron, Meade, you know, anything but
This statute is about private civil actions. and it doesn't affect the SEC's enforcement authority or any action. In fact, the SEC doesn't derive any greater power or lesser power as a result of the enactment of SLUSA. It is entirely legislated against private civil actions.
Have we not given any weight to SEC determinations as to its interpretation where civil actions are involved? I'm surprised.
This is an act, Justice Scalia, where the SEC's enforcement authority isn't affected one jot. And so I think it would be a strange application of Chevron or even Skidmore deference to say that the SEC gets some special weight because it's construing words in an enactment that's addressed to private civil litigation.
You know whether the SEC filed an amicus brief in Blue Chip?
Yes. And it took the position there that in connection with did have a broad construction, and that position was rejected.
It took the position that the Seventh Circuit took in Eason, didn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah.
But the court there, I don't think, was — it said that it was not in giving any deference to the SEC's position because it was an implied private right of action that this court had recognized and that the lower courts had recognized.
Before you finish, there's two questions I'd like to ask him. One is, we know about the holder claims. They are saved for state actions. They're not preempted. What else would fall in this category that is not — that SLUSA doesn't affect, that can be brought as class actions in state court?
Well, there are class actions that concern breaches of fiduciary duty, negligence, and the question of whether or not they are in connection with purchase or sale is going to have a profound impact on whether or not those claims are also preempted. I can't spell out for you what the necessary consequences are, but there are a lot of state law claims brought under blue sky laws and other state remedies that traditionally have been observed and brought even as state claims, but under the all-encompassing parameter of in connection with purchase or sale advanced on the other side, a decision that would favor that could have unknown preemptive consequences, which I would submit would be contrary to the normal way you would put Congress to the test of determining did it intend to preempt those claims before adopting a broad interpretation that would do so. And if I could point out, one of the strange things about this case and the SEC's position is that district courts are going to be put in the rather unusual position of paying a rather high cost, because if they are confronted with a removal of a case brought under state law where the defendant asserts that it is preempted under SLUSA, and the SEC hasn't taken any action at all and has expressed no interest in this particular area, the district court, to determine preemption, has to intuit whether or not this is within the SEC's enforcement authority. So you have — ordinarily, you would have private plaintiffs suing for wrongdoing on the same side of the case as the SEC, as the public enforcer. But here you have them at loggerheads. And the only way that the district court can properly figure that out, whether or not the private victim can get a private remedy, is to cut back on the SEC's enforcement authority, if you will, would exact an awfully high cost. I would submit that that kind of an anomaly is a rather unusual one, particularly where the SEC isn't a party in the case and it is not being invited to submit a brief. And yet district courts, in order to determine the preemption question here, are going to have to rule against the SEC in order to give a private remedy or to recognize a private remedy under state law, or to cut back on a remedy under state law by holding that it is within the SEC's enforcement jurisdiction. Ultimately, what Merrill Lynch here is asserting is an immunity for a fraud that uniquely affects a certain class of holders who do not have a remedy under federal law. And I would submit that where any party is seeking to get an immunity from an intentional fraud, the party bears a heavy presumption that that is, in fact, what Congress intended. And I would submit to you that both with the language of the statute, the findings that Congress made in the legislative history, Congress did not express an intent to eliminate holder class actions of greater than 49 persons.
I agree with that presumption against preemption, where the question is, does this federal statute, which says nothing about preemption, accidentally preempt some state law. There the presumption makes sense. But here you have a statute, the whole object of which is preemption. And I'm not sure that what you shouldn't do in that case is just give the language its most reasonable meaning with no thumb on either side of the scale.
But it's preemption to rechannel. And that's the important point, Justice Scalia. The point was not to allow state law claims under state court systems, but to rechannel those actions into federal court. And if there are a category of victims of frauds who have no federal remedy, it doesn't make sense to infer that Congress, without saying so, left those people without any remedy whatsoever.
Mr. Frederick, I want to be sure one question. I'm not sure I understood your argument about how the district court has to deny the right to the SEC, but the SEC wouldn't be bound by the district court's decision, would it?
Well, it depends on how the courts would construe these SLUSA cases as affecting the in connection with purchase or sale and the SEC enforcement authority. If you were to accept the premise that the court's Zanford and O'Hagan decisions are binding on the SLUSA preemption language, anytime a court is construing can I finish, Mr. Chief Justice? Anytime a court is construing that language in the SLUSA context, it would necessarily have a collateral impact on the SEC's enforcement authority.
Yeah, but the SEC could relitigate it, I would think. It wouldn't be bound by the judgment. It's a private suit.
It could certainly relitigate it, but the point of the persuasive authority of a construction of in connection with purchase or sale, I think, would have effects that are inappropriate.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Kasner, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Counsel referred to the findings in the legislation, and I know this court will go back and review those. The finding number 5 does not use the word certain anywhere in it. What finding number 5 does say, however, it is appropriate to enact national standards for securities class action lawsuits involving nationally traded securities while preserving the appropriate enforcement powers of state securities regulators and not changing the current treatment of individual lawsuits, quote unquote. Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg asked questions that I think illustrate that Congress could not have intended such an anomalous result by allowing holders' claims to proceed as non-preempted. Justice Breyer, as a practical matter, you are 100% right in the premise of your question. If this court agrees with that the court below is correct, every single securities class action that is brought in federal court from that day forward will have a companion claim brought with it, asserted by holders. And it's not simply holders in the fashion that Mr. Dabbitt appears, which is somebody who claims, I would have sold had I essentially known inside information, a proposition which Judge Friendly expounded on in the Levine case in the Second Circuit. But you will also have holders — you will also have claims by people who come to court in the state court and say, you know, I would have bought securities if you had not issued such unduly pessimistic projections, just as was the case in the blue chip stamp case. And imagine the impact that that result would have on the safe harbor, which Congress enacted with the PSLRA to protect public companies in the United States and abroad, encouraging them to make forward-looking statements. If you allow a result which affords putative people who would have bought and would have sold in state court where the safe harbor doesn't apply, you will absolutely be gutting the statutory protections that Congress was seeking to protect. I'd like to just make one point about the Weinberger v. Kendra case that is mentioned. That involved an approval of a federal court class action where state law holders' claims were being released. In fact, the consideration that was approved there was less because the claims were weaker. We've heard a lot, Your Honors, about why Congress didn't mention holders' claims by name. The reason they didn't mention holders' claims by name is that it wasn't until SLUSA was enacted and creative plaintiff strike suit lawyers brought holders' claims in an effort to avoid SLUSA that this problem became exacerbated. But there is no doubt that the plain and natural meaning of SLUSA picks up all claims by any private party in connection with the purchase or sale of security.
It's so surprising that the holder claims didn't respond to Blue Chip. I think your argument would suggest they should have responded to Blue Chip by bringing a whole host of holder claims in state court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.